Hello, and welcome back to the Cambridge American History Seminar podcast. Dr. Eric Matheson, a senior lecturer at the University of Kent, is our guest this week. He's here to discuss his paper, The Problem of Free Labour and the Origins of the Republican Party. Dr. Matheson is the author of The Loyal Republic, Traitors, Slaves and the Remaking of Citizenship in Civil War America, as well as numerous articles. Rob O'Sullivan, PhD candidate here at Cambridge and historian of the Irish-American immigrant experience, joins in the conversation. Thanks a lot to both, and I'm your regular host, Hugh Wood. Eric, if you could just tell us a bit about your paper, where and when are we in the world, what's going on, and what's the kind of central argument thesis that you want to get across?
Where we are in the world is the 1840s, late 1840s, 1850s, and the subject of the paper has everything to do with the origins of the Republican Party, and looking at the Republican Party less as a kind of insular creation of American sectionalism, and more as a product of a much larger set of debates and events that were occurring in the Atlantic world, principally the kind of 1848 revolutions, which really kind of kickstarted a real concern on the part of a lot of Republicans, as I argue in the paper anyway, or would-be Republicans, about free labor and about what it would take to forge a new kind of consensus out of the kind of shattered remains of the American political system. So it is, in one sense, looking at free labor as an idea, but it's also looking at free labor as a tool and focusing attention on the problems of free labor, and in particular, the many failures of free labor across the middle decades of the 19th century. And as I argue in the paper, the creation of the Republican Party was a kind of devil's bargain. On the one hand, you could use free labor as a tool to kind of bring a lot of different constituencies together. But doing so also meant ignoring or papering over all of the problems of free labor and swallowing this very flawed idea whole. And that was kind of the thing that created the Republican Party. And it would have lasting consequences.
So how did you kind of come to write this? What about the existing kind of free soil historiography did you find was, I don't want to say lacking, but...
Yeah, what was lacking? I suppose I came to it out of, from Eric Foner's book. So his book in 1970 called Free Soil, Free Labor, Free Men, which is kind of a totemic book in American political history. I had a huge amount of respect for the book, as most people do, but I, having started a project on the history of free labor that kind of predates Eric's book, it occurred to me that there were some things in it that he was not at the time paying as much attention to. And in particular, it was this idea that free labor was an alloyed good thing. And it occurred to me that, coming as it did in the 1970s, in the middle of the New Left and that sort of thing, ideas about the, you know, sort of Cold War raging, the critique of free labor, he kind of edges up towards it and kind of nudges it a little bit, but he doesn't really explain it in any meaningful way, or at least in a way that I found really satisfying. So that's where the chapter starts. The book is, it's part of a bigger project, and the book is way too big, but it's it runs from like the kind of late 18th century of through to the late 19th century, and this is kind of the middle chapter of the book. I think at this point is bearing an awful lot of weight, and it might be too much for it at the moment, but that's kind of where the paper sits in the bigger hole.
Brilliant, thank you.
So, Eric, where would you see this piece fitting within the historiography of the emergence of the Republican Party? Do you think it gives ground to the side of the kind of the radicalism of the Republicans, a position associated with people like Jim Oakes, Matthew Carp, or does it fit more within the scholarship of people who emphasize the conservatism of the movement, like Adam Smith, Matthew Mason, you know? Or do you, you know, take your own position that doesn't do justice to, give justice to either of them and says, you know, you're both wrong.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice? I think I think a lot of the work on the Republican Party, and, you know, as you said quite rightly, you know, Jim and Matt's work on one end and Adam Smith and others on the other side of things, to me the argument itself is an insular argument, right? Around about the late 1840s, American historians start to get tunnel vision, and everything that happens in that decade, and certainly everything that happens in the decade that follows it, the Civil War, its aftermath, Reconstruction, all that stuff, it's seen through this very, very narrow prism. And that was the thing that I wanted to break out of and to sort of try and pick my head up as best as possible, in part because the people that I was paying attention to, various Republicans who were sort of, or would-be Republicans who were kind of casting around for evidence to support free labor's virtue, they themselves were looking around too, looking at a wider world, the larger Atlantic world. They were obsessed with Jamaica and lots of other Caribbean colonies. And so, to me, that argument is a really, really relentlessly insular argument. And I think if we were to kind of open up the aperture of the camera a little bit and to see a wider world, we would understand that there was a bit of both in the development. So I guess that does put me middle of the road. But having said that, I think that it's that kind of sort of regional transatlantic vision that kind of got me started, and was kind of my way into the chapter. You know, I think that work is really interesting, and you know, we can talk at length about whether or not Republicans were or weren't radical. You know, either it's, you know, giving a backstory to Bernie Sanders or giving a backstory to, I don't know, Mitt Romney or whoever, whatever the case might be. It struck me that's the wrong kind of question to be asking, and that actually the Republican Party is as much a product of its wider moment as it is that kind of sectional magnet that sort of draws all events into focus.
Yeah, absolutely. And reading your piece, it's impossible to not be struck by just how much of a titanic event the 1848 revolutions in Europe are for Americans. So could you tell us a little bit more about this? And also say, where do you see your piece fitting in with the historiography there of American engagement with these revolutions?
Yeah, I think the idea of the revolution itself as being this very kind of last gasp of the age of revolution, which is how kind of people like Eric Hobsbawm and others have seen it. I think historians kind of swallowed that idea whole, and more recently people like Richard Evans and Chris Clark and others have kind of cracked it open a little bit, and I think it's done that moment a lot of good. In particular, it's done it a lot of good in terms of how Americans saw it, because the evidence of just how much they were interested in these events, I mean, it splashed all over newspapers across the United States. They followed these events with a tremendous amount of awe, but also worry about what was going to happen to them. And as I say in the paper, that there was that kind of base sense that somehow these revolutions were not going to touch us. They weren't going to be a huge concern, because they were revolutions that were kind of calling for the creation of polities that were very similar to the United States. And for that reason, you know, we were safe. We could take a breath. Not a big deal. But the kind of the working classes of Europe and the way in which they rose up in to some success more than others, in depending on where you looked, that was the big concern, that was the big worry, and that was to say nothing of also immigrant populations moving to the United States and what kind of ideas were they bringing with them, that sort of thing. So that was kind of the way that Americans saw it. As far as where I fit, I mean, you know, the work on the age of that particular revolution is incredibly complex, and it depends on where you choose to plant yourself. You know, Chris Clark spends many, many hundreds of pages trying to unpack that particular question. You know, I think that probably my interest in it has less to do with that literature, and I don't have any skin in that particular game, really. It was more in trying to drag the revolution into an argument or a debate that I thought American historians had long been having that needed to be kind of given a zhuzh. That was the that was my principal aim. But yeah, I think that that revolution was a really interesting one, and the ambivalence with which American the way that historians see it is a very ambivalent kind of treatment of that period. It's at once revolutionary and then at the same time not, and you know, there's a lot of pushing and pulling going on. But I think the fact that it comes when it does, at the same time as the Mexican War, at the same time as all these other changes are taking place in the United States, it was no accident that they were concerned. And in that way, the Republican Party emerges as a reaction to those things as much as it does sectional worries about slavery and its future in the country and that sort of thing.
Brilliant, thank you. I kind of want to ask you a bit more of a nuts and bolts question. Sure. About the revolutions and the 1848 revolution. So where are Americans getting their information about that European labor conflict from? Is it from kind of British journalists, American journalists, or from like non-English language sources from Europe itself? And also, where in American society is that danger kind of registering? Is it more amongst elites and people who would be reading, I don't know, the Times?
Yeah.
Or is it in, you know, working class populations as well?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I think a lot of newspapers were republishing things. But having said that, there were a lot of working class publications. You know, there were more of them in the 1830s than there were in the 1840s. But even still, there was a real kind of groundswell of interest in the subject. And, you know, off the back of Chartism and all the rest of it, there were a lot of interested parties who were sort of looking at which way the wind was blowing. But I think from the Republican Party's perspective, it was elites. It was principally kind of moneyed interests who were trying to figure out how to build some kind of consensus, some new party. It was clear that, you know, single issue parties like the Free Soil Party wasn't gonna fly, really. I mean, it had legs in some parts of the country, but not in others. And you know, it had a shelf life. The question was, how do you build something lasting, and how do you cobble together all of these different constituencies? And that was their big concern. And they lit on free labor as a really important thing, in part, I think, because free labor was kind of the 19th century equivalent of identity politics. It was a way to talk about how people feel as much as a policy position. Republicans never came out and said, we're for free labor, and therefore, as a plank in our platform, we'll have the following policies were we to get into power. They just said, we're for free labor. Well, anyone can be for free labor. You know, you can say lots of things on a stump speech. But I think they saw that as a really important kind of nod, a knowing nod in the direction of a lot of constituencies who would not otherwise, or who would see the class politics of the moment first, right? Who would see that this person is an elite. Why am I paying attention to this person? You know, free labor was that way to kind of bridge that gap. That gap was only growing as the 1850s wore on. So I think that was the principle. Constituency, if you like, or sort of paying attention to it.
Cool, thank you. Yeah, you've kind of gone into this a little bit with your previous answer, but I would like to ask about the term itself and kind of where it came from. Yeah. So the question was how much the idea of free labor is a political slogan rather than a fully worked out political program, which you have addressed. But was the term kind of utilized because it was more romantic than, say, like wage labor. Which doesn't sound really like that enticing.
Doesn't carry with it that same kind of ringing. Yeah, whatever. So free labor has a really old history with very, very old sort of legal roots. It dates back to the 13th century, basically. So the you know, kind of after the Black Death, there was a concern about a free labor population not working. Would they demand higher wages, that sort of thing? So the legal structures that were put in place around what could best be called free labor was very old and venerable, and it was based on coercion, principally. It was based on how do you get people to work when they don't want to? How do you get people to do jobs that they would not otherwise want to? The free part of the free labor was the bargain, right? It was you have a wage, and therefore when your contract, your term of service ends, you can go and work for somebody else if you want. The aspirational quality of free labor is, I think, the really important thing. And the fact is that Republicans could have said, we're for free soil, wage labor, and free men. And it's not just the alliterative quality in that that they caught on to. It was the aspirational part of it that I think they really held fast to. That doesn't touch the sides of whether or not Americans were hearing that in the same way, right? You know, by the 1830s, certainly, most working class organizations and working class leaders had ditched the idea of free labor and were talking about wage labor and wage slavery as well. So there was that kind of push and pull among working class communities and working class groups. But they didn't ultimately take issue with the question of free labor. And that's telling to me. It's telling that they kind of tacitly agreed with this idea that free labor was free. It extended to people some measure of independence. But yeah, it carries with it those old legal roots. And I think those are the things that were kind of papered over and covered up. Because ultimately, you know, controlling labor is one of the keys to any economy, and whether it's the 19th or in the 21st century. So yeah, the notion of it being free, it was kind of nominal by the 19th century, and I think most people knew it.
Thank you. Building on that answer, I'm wondering, reading your paper, whether the embrace of free labor as a political slogan serves more to challenge the aristocratic slave power than it does to necessarily advocate for a world of racial equality after slavery. So does the slogan benefit the white worker more than it does the black enslaved, as many abolitionists would have alleged at the time?
Yeah. I think probably that's the case. Yes. I mean, I think, you know, whenever I was thinking about this paper, I was thinking about the work of people like Chris Brown and his idea in the late 18th century of what abolitionists could imagine, right? An expanding horizon of possibility. I think it's absolutely true that by the 1850s, most Republicans, if you were to talk to them about free labor, they would have automatically assumed a white working class laborer working in a factory somewhere rather than an enslaved person. The idea of just transplanting free labor into enslaved economies and, you know, with emancipation kind of bringing free labor into you know, the emancipating South or something like that. I think that was such a far off idea by the 1850s. It really wasn't on their minds. If you'd pushed them, maybe Republicans might have said, oh, you know, it would be a great idea if, and, you know, this provides us with a model. But the big reason, as I say in the paper, the big reason why they didn't do that in the 1850s was because of all the failures that free labor had experienced as an idea and as an economic system prior to this point. And Republicans had to move mountains to avoid talking about it, because there was so much evidence to suggest that post-1833, the vast majority of British colonies that were formerly enslaved were in dire straits. And it was largely, I mean, there are lots of reasons, but one of them surely was because formerly enslaved people weren't interested in free labor in the way that it was defined. They wanted something else. They wanted something different, to be a petty peasantry, you know, something very different. They wanted to own their own land and that sort of thing. So the notion of wage labor being the cure-all, the answer to enslaved people's plight post-emancipation just wasn't on the radar. It would become something that in later chapters of the book I do talk about this, that it does kind of bubble up to the surface, and you have Republicans sort of saying, maybe we should just do this, right? This makes sense. But it was off the back of a cocktail napkin. I mean, it really wasn't as well planned or well thought out as people kind of give them credit for seeing it as, you know.
In that same vein then, what is the legacy of free labor? How does the concept come to be used after emancipation and after the Civil War? The works that immediately came to my mind as I'm reading is works by people like Hidetaka Hirota and Kevin Kenny about how the concept gets used on the West Coast to restrict Chinese immigration. You know, paradoxically, using what is essentially an anti-slavery concept to restrict Chinese immigration by saying we're only interested in people who are going to be free laborers, not kind of coolie laborers, as they would see it. And so can you tell us a little bit about that and also any other type of ramifications from the concept?
Yeah, I think that's very much where the idea goes. And, you know, of course, the idea of Chinese migrant laborers and the kind of their reaction to this kind of imposition of free labor, you know, it has an antecedent, of course, and that's in the 1830s when you have hundreds of thousands of Indian migrants moving to the Caribbean to become indentured servants, and they sign contracts and all the rest of it, and they're counted as free laborers too. So that argument, that focus on the Caribbean, does kind of circle back after the Civil War to kind of inform the way that people were thinking about a variety of other peoples. The person I had in mind when I started the project was Amy Drew Stanley's work. So her kind of legal understanding of how free labor was kind of being used and co-opted during the and immediately after the Civil War. That was sort of my touchstone. It was the one book I read in graduate school. One of the books I read in graduate school. One of the many. But it was one of those books that sort of had this clarifying aha moment for me. And I thought, oh, I get it now. I understand something of how this all works. It was like unpacking a really complicated idea in a very sort of straightforward way. But it definitely has an afterlife that is massive. And it's still with us, you know, the number of people who count themselves as free laborers and having independence and having that be the more important thing than the benefits that you might have if you're an Uber driver or something like that. All of those kinds of modern day, ideas about labor, which I think have a taproot back to the 19th century, which we don't examine because we feel like, well, this is the only thing. There are lots of problems with labor in a modern capitalist economy, but we seem to have just accepted them as is, and we don't question them. And part of the reason why we don't question them, I think in the American case, is because of this moment. We don't question it because in the 1850s, Republicans held this idea up as being the future, and we all just we just buy into it with every generation. We don't think about it in a kind of more historical, more contextualized way. So that was kind of my aim for the book, the big book.
Brilliant. So for our final question, I'm going to repeat one of the final lines of your paper back to you and ask you to expand on it a little bit. So we're after the Civil War now, and you say that pounding the occupied and emancipating American South into alignment with the Republican United States did not simply fail to lift the formerly enslaved out of poverty. It failed because free labor's architect baked the contradictions into policy without ever examining the fundamental problems which were readily apparent if anybody cared to look. Could you please expand on this a little? Should readers take from the piece that post-war Reconstruction was doomed to fail?
Right. That's a big one.
Yeah.
That's a nice way to end.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, that's good. I think a lot of the project is about trying to unpick Reconstruction. And that's sort of, as I say, with Amy Drew Stanley's book, that was kind of where I started. I think I was trying desperately to sort of figure out what I thought about Reconstruction and why it is I felt like we write about it as we do. I think that that ultimately this was the problem with Reconstruction is I think that the ideas that would form the kind of ideological core of Reconstruction were already hardened into concrete by the time you get to the Civil War itself. There wasn't a lot of flexibility in it. If you know, read the kinds of things that were happening in the emancipating South during the war and even in the immediate aftermath, you have this constant this constant effort on the part of unionists to sort of they're beating their heads against brick walls trying to make this system go, and they can't understand why it won't go. Why doesn't it work? Why aren't they doing the things that they want to do, or the things we want them to do? And certainly for African Americans, it was the same thing. It was we don't want this. We want something different. So I think that I'm not as interested actually in whether or not Reconstruction failed or succeeded. I want to understand a little bit of why its architects thought, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, that it was just going to be a success. It had to be a success. That was their kind of, it's like magical thinking. It's sort of like imagining something despite all evidence to the contrary and just saying, well, we just have to will it into being and we just have to try harder at it and it will make it work. And actually, I think, you know, whether that's a success or a failure, you know, I think that I'm more interested in the effort that they put into trying to magic up some kind of idea that was going to just sort of be a cure-all. And of course it wasn't.
Yeah. Alrighty. Well, on that note, I think we'll call it a day. But thank you very much for joining us, and thanks, Rob, as well.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.